Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be talking with Bay Area actor, comedian, radio talk show host, playwright, and author Brian Copeland about the remounting of his show, Not a Genuine Black Man, at the Marsh here in San Francisco. From San Francisco Opera and the production of Electra, I'll talk with dramatic soprano Christine Gerke, who sings the title role in this Richard Strauss opera based on the classical Sophocles. Also joining the conversation is maestro Enric Nanasji, making his San Francisco Opera conducting debut with this opera. Plus a talk with singer, actor-songwriter, and performance artist Taylor Mack about his 24-decade history of popular music at the Curran in San Francisco. An epic four performances, this 24-decade history is a multi-year effort to chart a subjective history of the United States through a unique mashup of music, history, performance, and art from 1776 to the present day. Stay with us. The Marsh here in San Francisco has announced that Not a Genuine Black Man, the longest-running solo show in San Francisco theater history by award-winning actor, playwright, and talk show host Brian Copeland, will be extended even longer, now on Saturdays through October 21st. Brian has been in show business since he first stepped on the comedy stage at age 18. Soon he was headlining clubs and concerts across the country, opening for such artists as Smokey Robinson, The Temptations, Ringo Starr, Aretha Franklin, and in venues such as the Universal Amphitheater to Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. Brian then branched off into TV, appearing on comedy programs on NBC, A&E, and MTV. He then spent 5 years as co-host of San Francisco Fox affiliate KTVU breakfast program, Mornings on 2, and 2 years hosting the San Francisco ABC affiliate KGO's Emmy Award-winning talk show, 7 Live. Back in 1995, KGO premiered The Brian Copeland Show, which remains the most listened to program in its time slot, reaching more than 100,000 listeners today. The Brian Copeland Show is heard weekday afternoons from 2 to 4 on KGO 810 AM, where Brian is off to after our conversation today. In addition to Not a Genuine Black Man, Brian's other theatrical works include The Scion, A Tale of Privilege, Murder, and Sausage, the critically acclaimed Christmas classic show, The Jewelry Box, and the unflinching examination of depression called The Waiting Period, which won the 2015 Theater Bay Area Award for Outstanding Production of a Solo Play. His next play, Grandma and Me, an Ode to Single Parents, will debut at The Marsh in the spring of 2018. Such a pleasure to welcome back Brian to our studios, our newly fabbed out studios, isn't that?
Oh, really nice. No, I think I may stay here. I may not go back to KGO today. These are nice digs.
Well, we're getting there. We need a little bit of work on the branding and the
logos. Your chairs look so much more comfortable than my chair that I use every afternoon. Can I just take the chair with me?
That's our thank you gift for today.
I was going to say, paid for by listeners like you.
How about, Brian, for a pledge of $300, the chair is yours. Anyway, my first reaction to just reading these introductions is, please slow down a little bit, for Christ's sake.
It's hard to hit a moving target, you know that.
Well, good for you. I mean, you're so active. Let's first talk about the return of Not a Genuine Black Man. And for those who haven't caught the show yet, how did the title come into being? Now, was this something that you were called growing up?
Well, you know, growing up, I heard all that nonsense about, you know, you're an Oreo, you're not really black, you know, and this, you know, that kind of nonsense.
But why, in your particular case?
Well, that's what I decided to explore this. Okay. So where this came from was I knew that I wanted to do a one-man show after doing 20 years of stand-up. I didn't know what to write about, and I had Carl Reiner on as a guest. Carl's one of my comedy idols. And Carl said, what you got to do is find a piece of ground that you alone stand on, that nobody else does, and write from there. He goes, you know, when I was in that position, he goes, I just finished working with Sid Caesar, no idea what I was going to do. I got that advice, and I thought, what's my piece of ground? I'm a married comedy writer. I live in New Rochelle with my wife and kids. I write for a comedy show in New York. That idea became the Dick Van Dyke Show. So he said, you got to find your piece of ground. So I don't know what that is. He goes, that's what you got to figure out. So then I get this letter, and I don't know if the letters you get in public radio from listeners are the same kind of letters that we get in commercial talk.
Well, let's see. Give us an example.
Well, they basically come from two sources. Letters through the post office. I'm not talking emails, but actually physical letters through the post office. Generally two sources, old ladies and nuts. That's it. Sweet old ladies write to you, and kooks write to you.
I'll bet you our general manager, Matt Martin, could attest to that to a certain degree. But we have such a wonderful support base of public radio listeners here that it's pretty amazing. We get such lovely comments for the most part. I imagine the negatives are significantly less than the positives.
Yeah. I got to believe that they must be. So I get this unsigned typewritten letter that says, as an African-American, I'm disgusted every time I hear your voice because you are not a genuine black man. And I thought, bingo, that's my piece of ground. For some reason, you know, I have heard this nonsense, as I said, for a lot of my life.
He didn't copyright that phrase, I hope.
Well, if he did, it's too late now. So I went through this whole examination about what's black and what's not black, and why I get this grief is because I spent my formative years as the only black face in the room. When my family moved to San Leandro in 1972, when it was overwhelmingly white, 90, depending on whose numbers you believe, but somewhere between 94 and 99% white.
Well, what was the motivation for your family moving to San Leandro, which was called a racist bastion of white supremacy? Was there a genuine idealism there?
Well, actually, you got to remember, we didn't know that. And most people in the Bay Area were not aware of this story until I opened Genuine in 2004. And a lot of people were just shocked that, you know, this kind of thing went on in the Bay Area. You know, and that's the whole thing, is that if this story had taken place in, you know, Mississippi or somewhere, people would have said, and your point is what? But this is, you know, 20 miles from San Francisco and 15 miles from Cal and, you know, 5 years after the Summer of Love. And you have this white flight community that is militantly anti people of color. There was a redlining and just a plan in place with the homeowners associations controlled the city and who was and was not a fit person to move in, and they controlled the city council, and the whole thing was enforced by the police department. You know, they used to call the border at Durant and East 14th Street at the Oakland San Leandro border the invisible wall, because there was a cop whose beat it was to sit there, and anybody who crossed over the city line, any African-American man, woman, or child, they either followed them until there was a pretext to stop them, or until they were so intimidated they turned around and drove back across the border to Oakland.
Wow.
So the way we got there was we were from Akron, Ohio, and moved around a lot between 1970 and we left Akron to 1971. At this point, we were in Hayward, was the last place before San Leandro. We lived in Hayward, and my father, who I portray in the show, was very abusive. And at one point, I'm 8 years old, and he strangled me to the point of unconsciousness.
Wow.
And my mother said, that's it, we're going to get away from him. And she found us this place in this apartment complex in San Leandro.
But had no idea of the context that she was walking into.
Not of the context, no. But she thought that my mother was a social climber. My mother was what black folks call sadidi. She was born in Birmingham, but used to tell people she was from Providence, Rhode Island, because it sounded better. And so she thought this was a more prestigious place to live at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got a rude awakening pretty early.
Well, this, you know, debuted, as we mentioned, in 2004, recalling the time in the 70s of your childhood. Did you imagine that the issues that you recount in the play would be as relevant in 2017?
Well, no, I didn't. I did Genuine for 8 years. I did Genuine in over 30 cities. We were off Broadway, LA, all over the place for 8 years. And then, you know, Barack Obama was elected, and he had all of this talk of a post-racial America. And it's like America moved on, so did I. And I did the other plays that you mentioned. In fact, the play Grandma and Me, David Ford, my director and collaborator, and I were going to, we were going to debut that play now, this fall. Then all of this Trump stuff, and the white supremacy stuff, and the Confederate apologists, and the false equivalents, and I just said, you know what, we have to, I have to bring this back, and it resonates now. That's the thing, that here's the thing that bothers me, and it's weird that this would bother me. It resonates more and in a different way now than it did when I originally opened it back in 2004. Mm. And that bothers me because it means that we're really in a bad place.
Well, especially with the hope that of that post-racial America that we all have. I mean, I cried at the inauguration ceremony of Barack Obama because it was so moving. It's like, wow, we've really come somewhere. Mm-hmm. That must be personally devastating to you as well as to what's happened in this reversal.
Well, it's devastating to, I think all thinking Americans. It's devastating, too, which is the majority of us. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we're talking about an ignorant vocal minority of 30 to 34, 35% of the country who will either make apologies or excuses for the positions that this administration takes. And I'm going to say this administration because they're following lockstep with the commander in chief.
Yeah.
And then you have another part of this core base that are true believers in this white supremacist lie. You know, and so it is, you know, and when I'm reading stories about how school children across the country are being bullied and they're calling it the Trump effect because of these children of color are being bullied by their classmates who are using Donald Trump's words verbatim. Using the verbatim words of the President of the United States to bully. And it's just, you know, I thought, okay, we need to have this conversation, and we need to America has lost her empathy. And in this show, I take the audience by the hand and I let you see the world through the eyes of an 8-year-old African-American boy in a place where there's no safe haven. There's no safe haven walking down the street because of the racism that's dealt with there. There's not a safe haven at home with a father who is abusive. And what is it like to be in those shoes for the 2 hours of this show?
Mm-hmm. Now, you developed this originally with David Ford,
right,
the longtime incubator-in-chief, I like to call him, at The Marsh, mm-hmm. and elsewhere, for that matter, who remains your director for this run. What has he contributed to this particular incarnation of the show?
Well, in this incarnation, we have not worked together.
Okay.
It's the same show. There are references that I have updated, and, you know, certain lines or jokes here and there that would be dated to do today. That I have changed, but it's the same show, so I didn't really need to go into new direction. I mean, it's ingrained. I've literally done it 1,000 times.
Wow.
I've literally done 1,000 performances. I think we're coming up on performance number 1,000.
Wow, fantastic.
Of this show. Mm-hmm. But we've been working on Grandmommy. David and I have been working on the new play.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's focus for a bit on this and the book version of Not a Genuine Black Man, now required reading at a number of high schools and colleges throughout the country. That must be satisfying.
Yeah, that's just bizarre. I started getting emails from college students and high school students who were assigned to read it, and there are professors who sent from various colleges who have sent me the midterms. Emails of the midterms, and it's questions about my life on a midterm exam. I mean, it's surreal. Other surreal thing is that there are high school kids, three that I know of, that have taken excerpts from the book and used them in national speech competitions. And, you know, the most recent was a kid from, I believe from Detroit, who placed second in nationals doing a scene from the book. So it's just, this was supposed to be 6 weeks at the Marsh in 2004. And then I was booked at Rooster Teeth Feathers Comedy Club in Sunnyvale. 6 weeks, I'm done. That's out of my system. And next thing I know, it's the next 8 years of my life.
Wow, that's something. Thank you also. I mean, you're touching people in many ways, especially for the bravery that you displayed in the multiple runs of The Waiting Period. You no doubt have touched and perhaps saved a number of lives with your account of your own journey through depression.
We do The Waiting Period it's a project that we started actually back at the beginning of 2016, where I'm presenting this show for free to the public on Sundays. We were able to get it. We have a GoFundMe and donations, and it's really gratifying what's happened with that show. What The Waiting Period is about I went through a really, I've suffered from depression since I was a child, and I went through a really bad, bad bout in 2008 when just a series of my grandmother who raised me just died suddenly. I went through a divorce. It appeared a couple months. Car crash. Spinal cord injury from the car crash that almost left me quadriplegic. Surgery, and then immobilized to recover from the surgery for about 3 months. And so I was suicidal.
Wow.
So I went and I bought a 32 caliber Beretta Tomcat to shoot myself with. And California's got a 10-day waiting period. And what this play is about is what happens in that 10 days and just isn't genuine. As I said, you see the world through the eyes of a bullied African-American kid who's the other. In this show, you see the world through the eyes of somebody who's suicidally depressed or someone who's just dealing with depression, and you learn why saying, well, hey, the sun's shining, snap out of it, doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, yeah, it has saved lives. It's gotten people who were suicidal to, because the whole message is you got to tell somebody, you got to talk about it. And it's gotten people who are suicidal to seek help. It's gotten people who are not depressed, but who have family members who are, to number one, have more understanding of what they go through, but number two, on a number of occasions, to recognize the signs and prevent a suicide. That's happened a couple of times. Some guy came, girlfriend dragged him kicking and screaming to come and see the show because it's not his issue. And then he goes, gosh, Bob acts like that. And then he finds out that his brother was planning on committing suicide that week and stopped him. Heard another story about a kid who's same deal. His mom saw the show and thought he was acting odd based upon things in the show, and he had planned to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And she was able to stop him and get him help. So we do that show for free on, well, now it happened every Sunday, but we didn't raise enough money to do it for free every Sunday. So it's, I think the next show is going to be like the middle of October. And I've written a book version of that will hopefully be ready in October, and I'm going to make that available free to the public.
Great, great. And this particular show, Not a Genuine Black Man in This Incarnation, has been extended through the 21st of October.
Mm-hmm.
TheMarsh.org for some more information. So do tell us a little bit about the new work coming this spring, Grandma and Me, an ode to single parents.
Well, Grandma is one of the, she's a running theme through all of my work, and one of the most popular characters in all of my work. And what this is about is in 1979, when my mother died, Grandma was 58 years old and took on by herself five children, ages 14, me, the oldest, to my little sister, who was 11 months old, and she did it all by herself. And then you flip forward to the early 2000s, and I found myself in the same situation, you know, suddenly raising three kids by myself. And so it's about the trials and tribulations and things about single parenting, especially about single mothers, that people in this society just don't understand if they haven't been through it. And I've never gotten why single mothers are vilified, especially single black mothers are vilified in this society. They're the ones who stayed.
Right.
You know, they're the ones who stayed. So the show jumps back and forth between the two time periods and just the adjustments, and also how Grandma was looked at differently as a black woman, and my mother, a black woman with children and that she's raising by herself, is looked at with disdain. A man, black or white, who's got custody, who's a father, he's a hero. It's like, well, why am I a hero when I'm raising my children? If I were a woman, you'd be looking at me shaking your head. So we explore all of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's have you back to talk about that when we're getting closer to production. We're both lucky to be in what I like to call free-form radio,
mm-hmm. yeah.
having these unscripted conversations with people, you at KGO, me here at KLW. You're off to your show shortly, although you, of course, exponentially more than me in your tenure as a radio host. Could you maybe offer us a couple of brief words about why this sort of radio is important and public radio is important to support?
Well, here's one of the big reasons, and I want to preface this by saying that, you know, I've been in commercial radio now for 25 years, and I love commercial radio. However, on commercial radio, I can't do what you and I just did, and that is have an extended conversation where we go into depth without you having to cut me off mid-sentence at some point and go, well, hang on a sec, got to take care of some business.
Mattress commercial.
Got to stop. I'll be back. When I come back, you know, you know, to be able to explore ideas without that interruption. And to be able, among other things, too, to not have to be concerned about ratings as much as about content. And there also there are ideas, and there are topics, and there are guests that you will hear on public radio that you're not going to hear anyplace else. You know, I started in broadcasting. I started, you know, my first television show was at KQED. I did a late show for about 6 months, early 90s, called mm-hmm. Q. And then from there, I went to KTVU. And again, it's just a totally different experience when you're able to present things that you're not going to see other places.
800-525-9917. Thank you for that, Brian. We appreciate your support of local public radio as well. And let's have you back on to talk about your new show. But in the meantime, Not a Genuine Black Man is at The Marsh here in San Francisco on Saturday evenings through October 21st. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
And by the way, we've got some tickets for high donors, for pledges. You decide how much it is they have to pledge to get them, but we have some tickets.
All right, thanks, Brian. We'll give you passes to Not a Genuine Black Man for the first five people that would like a pair by calling our pledge line, 800-525-9917. Only by phone, please, 800-525-9917. A total of 10 pairs of tickets. 10 pairs of tickets offering. 800-525-9917 for a pledge of any amount to local public radio, KALW. Thank you so much for your support. Well, last week's opening festivities for the San Francisco Opera were truly memorable. You heard my conversation last week with Maestro Luisotti and tenor Brian Jade about Puccini's Turandot, which kicked things off on Friday. Still a few opportunities to catch that David Hockney-designed production. That was followed on Saturday, September 9th, with the return of Strauss's Elektra to the company's repertory for the first time in 20 years in a bold new production by English director Keith Warner. The intense one-act opera was presented with what the San Francisco Chronicle's Joshua Cosman called a cast for the ages, featuring renowned soprano Christine Gerkey in the title role. This past Tuesday, I had the distinct pleasure to talk with the conductor and title role soprano at the Opera House. Christine Gerkey, Maestro Nanazji, congratulations on the stellar reviews for the opening night, Christine especially, and you, Maestro, for your company debut as conductor.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be able to come back finally to San Francisco and in such an intriguing production and being able to work with this cast and this maestro, not just saying that because he's sitting here, although probably would help my career, but it has been an absolute pleasure to be back.
Thank you very much. I can say only the same. It's been a pleasure for me to conduct my very first Elektra in this wonderful opera house with this amazing company and with this fantastic orchestra and all the soloists who are really not just really great voices but also have amazing stage presence. So I can only say the best things about the whole thing.
Well, you're following in the footsteps, coincidentally, of past Hungarian conductors that made their debuts on this stage conducting Elektra. So before you was George Schulte in his debut role, and before him, Reiner. So you're following the Hungarian tradition of conducting Elektra at San Francisco Opera. You are on a Strauss binge of sorts. You're going to be returning to the Royal Opera House in January to conduct Salome. Are these Strauss operas new to your repertoire?
Yes, both Elektra and Salome are new. And I conducted Rosenkavalier. And it was a really interesting story also. I knew that I would do Salome at the Royal Opera. And then a few months later, I got the question if I want to do Elektra in San Francisco, and I just said, what an amazing year it could be, because, I mean, two of these operas especially, which are really very common in some ways and very, very similar in some ways, and both new for me, it's an amazing thing, and also because It's kind of really a Strauss year for me. I'm conducting almost all the big symphonic poems also this year, so with Heldenleben and Till and Zarathustra and Don Juan and all these things. So it's really nice to have the possibility to, you know, to go so deep in not just in one composition of a composer, but kind of, you know, follow his history and his life through these pieces. That's a really unique chance to get to know a composer in a really deep way, I think.
Oh, fantastic to hear that. That's amazing. Tell us a little bit about the orchestral forces that Strauss has required for this opera. It requires the most musicians of any opera, and at 95 bodies or so, the most ever in this particular pit. Is it just an increase in the forces, some selective doubling of instruments, or are there some instruments or sounds that we don't usually hear or see in the pit?
Yes, that's a special situation. I mean, the San Francisco Opera has a really big orchestra pit, but still, there is some people who don't fit in the pit. The fourth, fifth, and sixth trumpets, which come all in the very end, they have their place in the torpedo room, where they call it the torpedo room, so it's slightly under the stage. Uh-huh. But they were so amazing. I never needed to repeat this, part of the piece, because they were so amazing and so trained to do this. And also the celesta was down there. But I think it's this huge orchestration. I mean, Strauss knew that it became huge. But for him was Elektra a big challenge after Salome. Because once he wrote Salome, he was obsessed about this Sophocles thing and the drama, and he wanted to write it, but he knew, because it was right after Salome, it's supposed to be right after Salome, he was not sure if he can, you know, if he can do even more, if he can compose even more tension, even more intensity, because it's a similar psychological story. He was not sure, and I think he wanted it so badly, he was so obsessed that also the orchestration became huge, and I think he knew that. I mean, it was so interesting. He writes in a brief that when he was 60 and he had an anniversary performance of Elektra in Munich, and he conducted in the evening, and in the morning there was a rehearsal, one single rehearsal, and he came to the orchestra and started the piece with the five maidens, you know, the scene, and after 5 minutes he interrupted and he said to the orchestra, "Ladies and gentlemen, other than that, please, in the evening, don't play too loud. For some reason it became so loud, this piece." So he was aware about how much intensity he wanted in this piece, which also reflects the size of the orchestra. But nevertheless, the intensity of the piece is not because of how big the orchestra is, but because of the intensity everyone has to put in this piece, from the violinist on the last stand until all the singers, everybody. It has such a power. It's like really like a anaconda, which squeezes you, and you cannot get rid of. So I think the intensity is so huge, even if it would be only a half-size orchestra. Actually, he wrote a smaller version of Elektra, Salome, and Rosenkavalier for smaller theaters too. But it requires the best and the maximum from everyone. And I think that's why, even if it's only 1 hour 40 minutes, it's very exhausting in a great way, because you have to give your maximum.
It's been written that Strauss uses the orchestra almost like a character in the play, that it acts as the Greek chorus in this.
Yes, and even more. I mean, I think it's so amazing how he uses all these motifs and leitmotifs. So it's not just when a person is singing about something that the orchestra that he uses those leitmotifs in the orchestra, but he even uses the leitmotifs when somebody is thinking something. That's so amazing. So you don't hear any words about something, but the orchestra shows she is thinking this. Mm. And it is so complex in so many dimensions. That's amazing. Mm.
Christine, maybe for those of our listeners who are not honed up on their Sophocles, can you maybe give us a Cliff Notes version of the plot of Electra, which was subsequently condensed for the 90 or so minute libretto by Hofmannsthal?
Condensed. Okay, good luck. So let's see if we can do the long story short. Clytemnestra and Agamemnon are married, and Clytemnestra, along with Aegisth, who decided that it would be beneficial to both of them if they killed Agamemnon, and Electra, along with her sister Chrysotomus and her brother Orest, are the siblings who witnessed this and had to live with this. There's a bit that is not, in fact, in this opera that has been condensed, where if you sort of go back, you will find that there was another sibling, Iphigenia, and she was sacrificed to the goddess Diana, I believe, by Agamemnon, and that didn't work out very well for either one of them. So Clytemnestra had a reason to be upset with her husband, but we don't find that information in this piece. I find this very interesting and necessary to remember because, in fact, the extended scene, the confrontation between Clytemnestra and Electra, who has been put out in the courtyard because she is the dangerous one, I don't think she's dangerous because she's going to kill Clytemnestra. If she could do that, she would have done it already. But she's dangerous because Clytemnestra and Electra are both really brilliant women, and they're dangerous to each other because of that. And she remembers, Clytemnestra remembers what was done, and Electra also remembers what was done, and they both have reasons to be upset about this, and there's no impasse. They reached an impasse, that is. There's no solution to this, and so I don't want to spoil the ending, but it doesn't end very well for Clytemnestra.
Well, this is a role of a woman in distress, to say the least, hell-bent on revenge. You mentioned in an interview with San Francisco Classical Voice on how you see Electra as not going through the stages of grief, but being in all of them at once.
Mm-hmm. I really feel that way. You know, it's very interesting because people come at you and say, oh, well, you know, how is it to play such a crazy person? And the thing is, I don't find her crazy at all. I find her damaged, and I find that, in fact, there are so many correlations. We all know someone who has lost someone tragically. Probably not via an axe, but, you know, in a car accident or something, sudden or, you know, a disease. The stages of grief are pretty clear, and it's very easy to sort of find your way through those if you're seeing someone else to do it. It's never easy for anybody going through it. But I feel, though, that Electra, she pops in and out of all of them at all times. And she hasn't been able to go through with any of this and get closure. And so she keeps reliving all of this. And she's in every single stage of it at one moment or another. And it feels a bit schizophrenic, but I don't think that makes her crazy.
Tell us just a little bit about director Keith Warner's production, which premiered actually last year in Prague and staged here by Anja Kuhnhold and set by Boris Kudlicka.
It's a very, very... It's a very intellectual production. It's hard to find the word to explain this without giving it away to anybody who wants to come and see it. There are a lot of layers, and in fact, it takes the attention off of the Greek, ancient Greek part of things and sort of strips it down to bare emotions. And all of the familial, that is, relationships are intact. But you're definitely going to see them in a way that is perhaps more current.
Okay. Fair enough. Nicely done, I think. Summarizing. And just as an anecdote, this is no night in the museum. This, in fact, before Electra even makes the stage, this opera calls for several strong women roles. In fact, they set the scene before we even see Electra. That must be a challenge in terms of balance with the orchestra and to find women that can are at a level of maturity that can sing these roles as an ensemble.
You mean the Maids now? Yes. We have a fantastic group of singers who do this. And I think that the main thing is in this first 5 minutes, because it's always so difficult to start an opera, that you cannot have any singers for this. You have to have good singers for this. This must be singers who have all personalities. And also, it's composed like this. It's not like a group of people. It's every one of them is a personality, and that's why it's very important to have great personalities and great singers for that, which we had. And that's why it never was a real problem to have the right from the beginning, because that's the point, to have the right intensity for the piece. And I think they really prepare the room and the space then for Christine for her big scene at the beginning. So that's why we were very, very lucky to have these girls for this first scene.
Christine, you mentioned this being your return to San Francisco Opera. You were last year in 2006 in a fairly lighter role, Rosalinda in Die Fledermaus. Fair to say that you've gravitated towards these heavier roles, like Brunhilde, coincidentally, the title role of Turandot, which opened our San Francisco Opera season last week, and Elektra. Now, was this more a matter of being ready for them in your musical development? I understand that even though some people, like conductor Robert Shaw, wanted you to sing those dramatic soprano roles earlier in your career.
The funny thing is that very, very few people did not see this coming. I was one that didn't see this coming, but a lot of people did. And a lot of people, when I was in my 20s, heard a color that they really were positive was going in the dramatic direction. I was very lucky, in fact, because a lot of people who have very big voices, they don't have the opportunities to sing Mozart, to sing Handel, to sing lighter fare. And it kept me very safe, along with the fact that I just absolutely adored it. To this day, I miss singing Handel. And hysterically, I actually warm up with Cleopatra and Constanza in my dressing room before this. But it was more of an issue that the instrument started to grow. Everyone was right. And then it just became an issue of finding my way from Rosalinda into Chrysotomus, which was my first big girl role. I call them big girl roles. It's a little ridiculous, but it is a big girl role. And it turns out I was really holding my voice back, trying to keep it in the smaller repertoire, because that's all I knew. And I thought perhaps I had really done something very wrong, that it didn't feel as easy as it had. And in fact, what it was, and I remember it very, 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 very vividly, when I went out the first time and heard this orchestra, and it was Elektra, Stresto. So this big entrance for Chrysotomus near the end of the piece after Clytemnestra's little issue, for those of you who haven't come, I'm not going to ruin it. come find out what happens. But I walked out and, there were 8 French horns or something insane, and the amount of sound and the amount of excitement, I'm actually getting goosebumps right now thinking about it. I just sang, and it was the first time I felt like in my entire life that I could just use my whole instrument, and it felt like home. So it was quite a journey to get here, but once I got here, I realized that I belonged here. So I'm very happy where I've ended up.
And I guess there's no going back a certain extent, but now you're going forward with a role like Brunhilde and Isolde, your first Isolde.
I am definitely starting to work on that one. I tell you, she's... I'm glad I left it till the end of sort of the Wagner learns for me. I look at the score, and musically, I don't see anything that I haven't seen before that I don't know how to deal with, but she is a miraculous character, and she is like the Tosca of Wagner. She is all emotion all the time, and you have to walk that line between what is too far, and if you go too far, it will affect you vocally. But you have to be right on that line of where that can happen with Isolde, and it's a long time to do it. So I'm very happy I'm preparing it a few years in advance.
Coming back to this opera house sometime soon?
I certainly hope so, Matthew. I'm available. No, I really do hope so. I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed being back. The folks at the company here are so lovely to work with. The audiences are so excited. The community is excited. It's really nice to be in an atmosphere like that again.
Well, this will air on Thursday during KLW's fall membership campaign. Christine, you're a good Jersey girl, schooled on Long Island and influenced, I understand, by a very influential band director early on. Chances are you grew up on WNYC and WQXR. Do you maybe have a few words for our listeners about supporting public radio?
Absolutely. You know, when I was in college, I had a bit of a commute, and I constantly listened to public radio, and it was such a huge part of my learning experience. And even though I had my meager church job for $400 a month and was paying a lot of bills, I actually was a member. And it is really important, if there's any way, and if you enjoy all of the things that you're hearing as much as we enjoy putting them out there for you, it would be great if you could just forego that latte and anything that you might be able to spare, become a member. It's really important, and it's something that we can give to future generations.
Well, that just, I have to say, thanks a latte for that comment, Chris.
Oh, that was terrible. But thank you.
Maestro Nanasji, you are another interesting parallel. You, like our resident conductor, Maestro Luisotti, you too are in a final season as a general music director and at the Komische Oper Berlin. We wish you toi for your next moves, and thank you for spending some time today. We hope to see you back with the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. We hope that it's met your expectations.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure, and I hope to be back. Thank you.
Christine, toi for the rest of these performances.
Thank you very much.
Excerpt of the great Christine Gerke in the title role of Elektra in the San Francisco Opera production conducted by Ulrich Nanasji. A few more opportunities to catch Elektra at the San Francisco Opera, including a matinee this Sunday. Go to sfopera.com for all the details. In addition to the Chronicle's Joshua Cosman recommending your attendance, The Guardian said the night belonged to Christine Gerke. Her lament for her murdered father, Agamemnon, was agonizing. Her anger, white hot. Her torment, exquisite. It's hard to imagine better. sfopera.com for more information. Well, performance artist Taylor Mack's groundbreaking performance art concert, A 24-Decade History of Popular Music, is at The Curran, and it's originally a 24-hour continual experience. It's been reworked into 4 6-hour chapters with performances at The Curran tomorrow night at 5, Sunday at 2, and then next Friday and Sunday. I caught up with Taylor at The Curran. Here's a portion of that conversation. Taylor, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this will be the first full performance of this epic undertaking since last fall in Brooklyn, and that was a 24-hour marathon. Let's first talk about how you prepared physically and mentally for that.
Well, we marathon trained the show, so we spent about 6 years performing smaller sections of it, 90-minute just what we would call decade performances. So we just focus on one decade in the U.S. history at a time. And then we started to put them together, and we do 3-hour shows. And then we did a 5-hour show. We did a couple 6-hour shows. We did one 12-hour show. So over 6 years of performing and performing and performing, we performed maybe 200 shows in that six-year period. And that's how we built it. We rarely rehearsed. We would just perform, gig, and every time we would perform, we would build the show and make it a little bit better and adjust things. And so finally, when we got to St. Anne's Warehouse in New York, where we did the 24-hour show, we put it all together, and it just flowed.
Well, you lived for a time in Brooklyn. Where were you in Brooklyn?
I lived in Park Slope for about 8 years, and then the East Village, Park Slope, and now back kind of in the East Village.
Okay, well, whereabouts in Park Slope? Because we were there for 15 years on St. Mark's Ave, coincidentally, between 5th and 6th.
I was on Berkeley between 7th and 8th.
That's great.
I had a landlord, Old Man Joe, I called him. You know, he was 90, and he would always scream at me. It was very old school Brooklyn. It was really wonderful.
Well, the San Francisco presentation is sensibly divided into four different shows, along with some other presentations nearby. Does that represent a kind of compromise to your original immersive idea for the show?
Oh, God, no. The durational aspect of the show, first off, it's not a 24-hour show. It's an 8-year durational show. So that's really how I plotted it out and think about it, is that every time we perform it, it's part of the length of the show. I think the 6-hour shows are the sweet spot because they're challenging enough. 6 hours is not exactly easy to perform, sing nonstop for 6 hours. But it's also not easy for the audience, too, to be present for 6 hours is a challenge. It's not something they're usually asked to do. But they get to go home, sleep, think about what they experienced, decide if the next chapter is something they want to do, come to the next chapter if with an understanding of what the piece is, having digested the material up to that point. So it stops being about the event of it, which a 24-hour show, it's the event. It's only an event, you know, and the duration holds sway over material to some degree. You know, they're working in tandem, but the event, you know, was definitely the thing that people talked about. Whereas this experience is still an event, it's still challenging, still durational, but it allows you to focus on the material. And we have really, we've crafted this show just beautifully, I think, and I really love our material. So I want to share it with people, and I want them to be able to think about the moments and not be overwhelmed by the onslaught. Yeah.
Well, talk to me about how the concept of the whole thing began, and then a little bit about some of the specific music that you chose to represent each of these decades. I don't have to do every song. There were 233 songs, I understand. But what led you to choose some of them, and then how are you taking the tune and changing our pre-established perception of that tune by the way you're presenting it?
Yeah, well, First, every decade has something that everyone is familiar with, and every decade has something that people aren't familiar with. Maybe there's one person in the audience who has heard it before, but probably not. So that allows us room to play, and sometimes with the stuff that people aren't familiar with, we try to do it how we imagine it was originally intended to be performed. But the stuff that people are very familiar with, I like to tear apart a little bit. You know, I like to deconstruct them. I like to reframe them. So we might take something like Don't Fence Me In, which is, everyone knows it as this Bing Crosby riding through the countryside on horseback, you know, white man on horse, cowboy song.
Are you resetting it at the wall of the Mexico, United States wall?
Well, we don't have to, because there's, in the decade that it was written, the Japanese internment camps were also happening. Mm-hmm. So, and there was a Japanese swing band that was a Japanese-American swing band that was in the internment camp that would perform Don't Fence Me In.
Wow.
So we don't have to. I just have to dig into history a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I find the things that actually were going on, and I just put them in that context. We don't change the lyrics, but we just say, hey, think about this song in terms of this narrative now. And then that tells us, that informs us about the wall on Mexico that Trump is trying to build. You know, so that's one of the ways that we do it. You know, we do it differently almost every time. We'll take a song from 1786 and we'll make it punk. We'll take a, you know, so it's. We're always changing things and mixing it up, and the name of the game is surprise, you know, to keep everybody kind of on their toes about what is happening in the room and what's going on. So we're not placating the audience. They're on the edge of the seat with us, and sometimes standing.
Well, speaking of one of those reconceptions of tunes, there's an amazing video of Amazing Grace that you filmed here in San Francisco. Yeah. So it must be nice to come back to San Francisco to bring your whole show.
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy. The catalyst for the whole show happened in 1987 at the first or second AIDS walk that happened in San Francisco. I was a teenager, and I'd never met an out homosexual before, and suddenly I saw thousands of them for the first time, you know, all together, and they were trying to survive, and they were building themselves as a result of being torn apart. So that was the catalyst for the show. That's the whole theme of the show, is dealing with different communities throughout our history that are building themselves as a result of being torn apart, and that kind of festival, rally, political, emotional onslaught of the AIDS walk in 1987, of what people were going through. That's the thing that we're trying to capture metaphorically in our show and explore, using popular music as a way to help us do that.
You mentioned that your queerness has kind of shaped your artistry, and that part of this is your discovery of queerdom in America. You mentioned that they'll give us Walt Whitman, but begrudgingly.
Yeah.
So you're discovering more.
They'll.
The man.
The man will give us. Not just the man, the historians. You know, you hear people say over and over again that Lincoln wasn't a homosexual because the word hadn't been invented. Or they'll say, no, men cuddled with other men, you know, because he writes in his love letters to his lover at the time, you know, describing how they slept together and held each other in bed. And you know, the historians over and over and over again will say, that men just did that back then. They weren't homosexuals. And I said, well, that's fine. Then show that. Then write about that he slept with other men and let the people decide what that means for themselves. You know, I mean, it's just absurd. So I went through the public school system. I never once had anything taught to me about homosexuals ever in my entire education. So I think, well, they must have been there. Like, what were they doing? You know, who is that dandy in Yankee Doodle Dandy? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Gives a whole different meaning to A Penny for Your Thoughts with Lincoln on the penny.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, for me, identity politics are subplot but never point. So they're always the reference for contextualization, but they're never the reason, right? They're just, so yes, it's a queer show, but the show isn't really about queerness. I happen to be queer. Many of my collaboratives are queer, and so the show becomes queer. But the point is about these various communities that are being built as a result of falling apart, and the point is about these things that we have forgotten, dismissed, or buried, or that other people have buried for us. It's to do a reveal of those things. Now, some of them may be queer. A lot of them have to do with slavery. A lot of it has to do with all these different communities. Women's Lib movement, the same tactics that were used to stop Hillary Clinton from getting elected were the same tactics used to stop women from really galvanizing the first women's lib movement in the 1780s. Same exact tactics. Mm. So you have to say to ourselves, we have forgotten about this from the 1780s. This history, you know, as Gore Vidal says, is the United States of Amnesia. This history was there, and we let it happen yet again. Mm. It happened during Reconstruction. And it happened in World War I. 1861, when the women's were the suffragettes, and now it's happening, and here it just happened again. You know, it just keeps happening. And so we do have a responsibility, I think, as citizens to unearth this stuff and to make it present and make it part of our daily lives.
And part of a brief conversation, portion of the conversation I had with Taylor Mack. His shows at the Curran are running tomorrow night at 5 o'clock, Sunday the 17th at 2 p.m., Friday the 22nd at 5 p.m., and the following Sunday the 24th at 2 in the afternoon.
And I wish and wish again that I was back in the town where I was born. There's a farm in Michigan, and I'd like to fish again in the river that flowers beside the fields of waving corn. A lonesome soul am I, here's the reason why. I wanna go back, I wanna go back, I wanna go back to the farm, far away from harm, with a milk pail on my arm. I miss the rooster, the one that used to wake me up at 4 a.m. I think your great big city's awfully pretty, but nevertheless, I wanna be there, I wanna see there a certain someone full of charm. That's why I wish again that I were in Michigan, back on the farm. You can keep your cabarets that turn the nights back into days. I want to be where they go to bed at 9.
The beautiful voice of Taylor Mack. His epic 24-decade history of popular music is at the Curran, sfcurran.com, for more information. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air. I encourage you to try to attend tonight's gala opening of the San Francisco Symphony under its music director, Michael Tilson Thomas. The program tonight includes the Overture to Candide in celebration of Bernstein's 100th birthday, which they'll be celebrating in a number of concerts. Cello Concerto of Saint-Saëns with Yo-Yo Ma as soloist. Tchaikovsky's Variations on a Rococo Theme and Ravel's Bolero. Lots of fun. The tents are up. Party afterwards once you buy your ticket for the concert. Again, sfsymphony.org for more information. The opening gala of the San Francisco Symphony. Here's a bit of the Rococo theme of Tchaikovsky, which you'll hear tonight if you can come to the San Francisco Symphony and Yo-Yo Ma. On a Rococo theme, just a brief excerpt of that as we conclude Open Air for this Thursday, September 14th. A reminder that a donation of any amount during this hour will result in your being offered a ticket to Brian Copeland's one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, 800-525-9917 for more information, or go online to kalw.org and make a pledge there. Coming up next, it's an hour of news from the BBC, recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time. Listener-supported KLW, 800-525-9917. And a reminder that all of the open-air broadcasts are archived at our website, kalw.org, where you can make a donation anytime. Thank you for your support.